ever wicked, was scientifically true. They found that a majority of criminals came from unhappy homes, had a history of unhappy human relationships. A 10-year study of frustration at Yale University brought out that much of what we call immorality and hostility to others is brought about by our own unhappiness. Dr. Schindler has said that unhappiness is the sole cause of all psychosomatic ills, and that happiness is the only cure. The very word disease means a state of unhappiness, dis-ease. A recent survey showed that, by and large, optimistic, cheerful businessmen who looked on the bright side of things were more successful than pessimistic businessmen. It appears that in our popular thinking about happiness, we have managed to get the cart before the horse. Be good, we say, and you will be happy. I would be happy, we say to ourselves, if I could be successful and healthy. Be kind and loving to other people, and you will be happy. It might be nearer the truth if we said, be happy, and you will be good, more successful, healthier, feel and act more charitably toward others. Common misconceptions about happiness. Happiness is not something that is earned or deserved. Happiness is not a moral issue, any more than the circulation of the blood is a moral issue. Both are necessary to health and well-being. Happiness is simply a state of mind in which our thinking is pleasant a good share of the time. If you wait until you deserve to think pleasant thoughts, you are likely to think unpleasant thoughts concerning your own unworthiness. Happiness is not the reward of virtue, said Spinoza in his book Ethics, but virtue itself, nor do we delight in happiness because we restrain our lusts, but, on the contrary, because we delight in it. Therefore, are we able to restrain them. The pursuit of happiness is not selfish. Many sincere people are deterred from seeking happiness because they feel that it would be selfish or wrong. Unselfishness does make for happiness, for it not only gets our minds directed outward away from ourselves and our introspection, our faults, sins, troubles, unpleasant thoughts, or pride in our goodness, but it also enables us to express ourselves creatively and fulfill ourselves in helping others. One of the most pleasant thoughts to any human being is the thought that he is needed, that he is important enough and competent enough to help and add to the happiness of some other human being. However, if we make a moral issue out of happiness and conceive of it as something to be earned as a sort of reward for being unselfish, we are very apt to feel guilty about wanting happiness. Happiness comes from being and acting unselfishly, as a natural accompaniment to the being and acting, not as a payoff or prize. If we are rewarded for being unselfish, the next logical step is to assume that the more self-abnegating and miserable we make ourselves, the happier we will be. The premise leads to the absurd conclusion that the way to be happy is to be unhappy. If there is any moral issue involved, it is on the side of happiness rather than unhappiness. The attitude of unhappiness is not only painful, it is mean and ugly, said William James. What can be more base and unworthy than the pining, puling, mumping mood, no matter by what outward ills it may have been engendered? What is more injurious to others? What is less helpful as a way out of the difficulty? It but fastens and perpetuates the trouble which occasioned it, and increases the total evil of the situation. Happiness does not lie in the future, but in the present. We are never living, but only hoping to live, and looking forward always to being happy, it is inevitable that we never are so, said Blaise Pascal, the 17th century mathematician and philosopher. I have found that one of the commonest causes of unhappiness among my patients is that they are attempting to live their lives on the deferred payment plan. They do not live or enjoy life now, but wait for some future event or occurrence. They will be happy when they get married, when they get a better job, when they get the house paid for, when they get the children through college, when they have completed some task or won some victory. Invariably, they are disappointed. Happiness is a mental habit, a mental attitude, and if it is not learned and practiced in the present, it is never experienced. It cannot be made contingent upon solving some external problem. When one problem is solved, another appears to take its place. Life is a series of problems. If you are to be happy at all, you must be happy, period, not happy because of. I have now reigned above 50 years in victory or peace, said the Caliph Abd al-Rahman I, the 8th century ruler of Iberia. Beloved by my subjects, dreaded by my enemies, and respected by my allies, riches and honors, power and pleasure, have waited on my call, nor does any earthly blessing appear to have been wanting to my felicity. In this situation, I have diligently numbered the days of pure and genuine happiness which have fallen to my lot. They amount to 14. Happiness is a mental habit that can be cultivated and developed. Most people are about as happy as they make up their minds to be. Abraham Lincoln. Happiness is purely internal, said psychologist Dr. Matthew N. Chappell, author of In the Name of Common Sense and Back to Self-Reliance. It is produced not by objects, but by ideas, thoughts, and attitudes which can be developed and constructed by the individual's own activities, irrespective of the environment. No one, other than a saint, can be 100% happy all the time, and, as George Bernard Shaw quipped, we would probably be miserable if we were. But we can, by taking thought and making a simple decision, be happy and think pleasant thoughts a large share of the time, regarding that multitude of little events and circumstances of daily living that now makes us unhappy. To a large extent, we react to petty annoyances, frustrations, and the like with grumpiness, dissatisfaction, resentment, and irritability purely out of habit. We have practiced reacting that way so long, it has become habitual. Much of this habitual unhappiness reaction originated because of some event that we interpreted as a blow to our self-esteem. A driver honks his horn at us unnecessarily. Someone interrupts and doesn't pay attention while we're talking. Someone doesn't come through for us as we think he should. Even impersonal events can be interpreted and reacted to as affronts to our self-esteem. The bus we wanted to catch had to be late. It had to go and rain when we had planned to play golf. Traffic had to get into a snarl just when we needed to catch the plane. We react with anger, resentment, self-pity, or in other words, unhappiness. Stop letting things push you around. The best cure I have found for this sort of thing is to use unhappiness's own weapon, self-esteem. Have you ever been to a TV show and seen the master of ceremonies manipulate the audience? I asked a patient. He brings out a sign that says, "Applause," and everyone applauds. He brings out another that says, "Laughter," and everyone laughs. They act like sheep, as if they were slaves, and meekly react as they are told to react. You are acting the same way. You are letting outward events and other people dictate to you how you shall feel and how you shall react. You are acting as an obedient slave and obeying promptly when some event or circumstance signals to you, be angry, get upset, or now is the time to feel unhappy. Learning the happiness habit, you become a master instead of a slave. Or as Robert Louis Stevenson said, the habit of being happy enables one to be freed, or largely freed, from the domination of outward conditions. Your opinion can add to unhappy events. Even in regard to tragic conditions and the most adverse environment, we can usually manage to be happier, if not completely happy, by not adding to the misfortune our own feelings of self-pity, resentment, and our own adverse opinions. How can I be happy? The wife of an alcoholic husband asked me. I don't know, I said, but you can be happier by resolving not to add resentment and self-pity to your misfortune. How can I possibly be happy? Asked a businessman. I have just lost $200,000 on the stock market. I am ruined and disgraced. You can be happier, I said, by not adding your own opinion to the facts. It is a fact that you lost $200,000. It is your opinion that you are ruined and disgraced. I then suggested that he memorize the saying of Epictetus, which has always been a favorite of mine. Men are disturbed not by the things that happen, but by their opinion of the things that happen. When I announced that I wanted to be a doctor, I was told that this could not be, because my folks had no money. It was a fact that my mother had no money. It was only an opinion that I could never be a doctor. Later, I was told I could never take postgraduate courses in Germany, and that it was impossible for a young plastic surgeon to hang out his own shingle and go into business for himself in New York. I did all these things, and one of the things that helped me was that I kept reminding myself that all these impossibles were opinions, not facts. I not only managed to reach my goals, but I was happy in the process. Even when I had to pawn my overcoat to buy medical books and do without lunch in order to purchase cadavers. I was in love with a beautiful girl. She married someone else. These were facts. But I kept reminding myself that it was merely my opinion that this was a catastrophe and that life was not worth living. I not only got over it, but it turned out it was one of the luckiest things that ever happened to me. The attitude that makes for happiness. It has been pointed out earlier that since man is a goal-striving being, he is functioning naturally and normally when he is oriented toward some positive goal and striving toward some desirable goal. Happiness is a symptom of normal, natural functioning. And when man is functioning as a goal striver, he tends to feel fairly happy regardless of circumstances. My young business executive friend was very unhappy because he had lost $200,000. Thomas A. Edison lost a laboratory worth millions in a fire with no insurance. What in the world will you do? Someone asked. We will start rebuilding tomorrow morning, said Edison. He maintained an aggressive attitude. He was still goal-oriented despite his misfortune. And because he did maintain an aggressive goal-striving attitude, it is a good bet that he was never very unhappy about his loss. Psychologist H. L. Hollingworth said that happiness requires problems, plus a mental attitude that is ready to meet distress with action toward a solution. Much of what we call evil is due entirely to the way men take the phenomenon, wrote William James in The Varieties of Religious Experience. It can so often be converted into a bracing and tonic good by a simple change of the sufferer's inner attitude from one of fear to one of fight. Its sting can so often depart and turn into a relish when, after vainly seeking to shun it, we agree to face about and bear it cheerfully, that a man is simply bound in honor, with reference to many of the facts that seem at first to disconcert his peace, to adopt this way of escape, refuse to admit their badness, despise their power, ignore their presence, turn your attention the other way, and so far as you yourself are concerned at any rate, though the facts may still exist, their evil character exists no longer. Since you make them evil or good by your own thoughts about them, it is the ruling of your thoughts which proves to be your principal concern. Looking back on my own life, I can see that some of the happiest years were those when I was struggling through as a medical student and living from hand to mouth in my early days of practice. Many times I was hungry, I was cold and ill-clad. I worked hard a minimum of about 12 hours a day. Many times I did not know from month to month where the money was coming from to pay my rent. But I did have a goal. I had a consuming desire to reach it, and a determined persistence that kept me working toward it. I related all this to the young business executive and suggested that the real cause of his unhappy feeling was not that he had lost $200,000, but that he had lost his goal. He had lost his aggressive attitude and was yielding passively rather than reacting aggressively. "I must have been crazy," he told me later, "to let you convince me that losing the money was not what was making me unhappy. But I'm awfully glad that you did." He stopped moaning about his misfortune, faced about, got himself another goal, and started working toward it. Within 5 years, he not only had more money than ever before in his life, but for the first time, he was in a business that he enjoyed. Practice exercise. Form the habit of reacting aggressively and positively toward threats and problems. Form the habit of keeping goal-oriented all the time, regardless of what happens. Do this by practicing a positive, aggressive attitude, both in actual everyday situations that come up and also in your imagination. See yourself in your imagination taking positive, intelligent action towards solving a problem or reaching a goal. See yourself reacting to threats, not by running away or evading them, but by meeting them, dealing with them, grappling with them in an aggressive and intelligent manner. Most people are brave only in the dangers to which they accustom themselves, either in imagination or practice, said Bulwer Lytton, the English novelist. Systematically practice healthy-mindedness. The measure of mental health is the disposition to find good everywhere, Ralph Waldo Emerson. The idea that happiness, or keeping one's thoughts pleasant most of the time, can be deliberately and systematically cultivated by practicing in a more or less cold-blooded manner, strikes many of my patients as rather incredible, if not ludicrous, when I first suggest it. Yet experience has shown not only that this can be done, but that it is about the only way that the habit of happiness can be cultivated. In the first place, happiness isn't something that happens to you. It is something you yourself do and determine upon. If you wait for happiness to catch up with you, or just happen, or be brought to you by others, you are likely to have a long wait. No one can decide what your thoughts shall be but yourself. If you wait until circumstances justify your thinking pleasant thoughts, you are also likely to wait forever. Every day is a mixture of good and evil. No day or circumstance is completely 100% good. There are elements and facts present in the world and in our personal lives at all times that justify either a pessimistic and grumpy outlook or an optimistic and happy outlook, depending on our choice. It is largely a matter of selection, attention, and decision. Nor is it a matter of being either intellectually honest or dishonest. Good is as real as evil. It is merely a matter of what we choose to give primary attention to and what thoughts we hold in the mind. Deliberately choosing to think pleasant thoughts is more than a palliative. It can have very practical results. Carl Erskine, the famous baseball pitcher, said that bad thinking got him into more spots than bad pitching. As quoted in Norman Vincent Peale's Faith Made Them Champions, he said, "One sermon has helped me overcome pressure better than the advice of any coach. Its substance was that, like a squirrel hoarding chestnuts, we should store up our moments of happiness and triumph so that in a crisis we can draw upon these memories for help and inspiration. As a kid, I used to fish at the bend of a little country stream just outside my hometown. I can vividly remember this spot in the middle of a big, green pasture surrounded by tall, cool trees. Whenever tension builds up, both on or off the ball field now, I concentrate on this relaxing scene, and the knots inside me loosen up." Gene Tunney told how concentrating on the wrong facts almost caused him to lose his first fight with Jack Dempsey. "He awoke one night from a nightmare. The vision was of myself bleeding, mauled, and helpless, sinking to the canvas and being counted out. I couldn't stop trembling. Right there, I had already lost that ring match, which meant everything to me, the championship. What could I do about this terror? I could guess the cause. I had been thinking about the fight in the wrong way. I had been reading the newspapers, and all they had said was how Tunney would lose. Through the newspapers, I was losing the battle in my own mind. Part of the solution was obvious. Stop reading the papers. Stop thinking of the Dempsey menace, Jack's killing punch, and ferocity of attack. I simply had to close the doors of my mind to destructive thoughts and divert my thinking to other things." A salesman who needed surgery on his thoughts rather than his nose. A young salesman had made up his mind to quit his job when he consulted me about an operation on his nose. His nose was slightly larger than normal, but certainly not repulsive, as he insisted. He felt that prospects were secretly laughing at his nose or repulsed because of it. It was a fact that he had a large nose. It was a fact that three customers had called in to complain of his rude and hostile behavior. It was a fact that his boss had placed him on probation and that he hadn't made a sale in 2 weeks. Instead of an operation on his nose, I suggested he perform surgery on his own thinking. For 30 days, he was to cut out all these negative thoughts. He was to completely ignore all the negative and unpleasant facts in his situation and deliberately focus his attention on pleasant thoughts. At the end of 30 days, he not only felt better, but he found that prospects and customers had become much more friendly. His sales were steadily increasing, and his boss had publicly congratulated him in a sales meeting. A scientist tests the theory of positive thinking. Dr. Elwood Wooster, in his book Body, Mind, and Spirit, relates the testimony of a world-famous scientist. Up to my 50th year, I was an unhappy, ineffective man. None of the works on which my reputation rests were published. I lived in a constant sense of gloom and failure. Perhaps my most painful symptom was a blinding headache which recurred usually 2 days of the week, during which I could do nothing. I had read some of the literature of New Thought, which at the time appeared to be bunkum, and some statement of William James on the directing of attention to what is good and useful, and ignoring the rest. One saying of his stuck in my mind: "We might have to give up our philosophy of evil, but what is that in comparison with gaining a life of goodness?" Or words to that effect. Hitherto, these doctrines had seemed to me only mystical theories, but realizing that my soul was sick and growing worse, and that my life was intolerable, I determined to put them to the proof. I decided to limit the period of conscious effort to 1 month, as I thought this time long enough to prove its value or its worthlessness to me. During this month, I resolved to impose certain restrictions on my thoughts. If I thought of the past, I would try to let my mind dwell only on its happy, pleasing incidents, the bright days of my childhood, the inspiration of my teachers, and the slow revelation of my life work. In thinking of the present, I would deliberately turn my attention to its desirable elements, my home, the opportunities my solitude gave me to work, and so on. And I resolved to make the utmost use of these opportunities and to ignore the fact that they seemed to lead to nothing. In thinking of the future, I determined to regard every worthy and possible ambition as within my grasp. Ridiculous as this seemed at the time, in view of what has come to me since, I see that the only defect of my plan was that it aimed too low and did not include enough. The scientist then tells how his headache ceased within 1 week, and how he felt happier and better than ever before in his life. But, he adds, "The outward changes of my life, resulting from my change of thought, have surprised me more than the inward changes, yet they spring from the latter. There were certain eminent men, for example, whose recognition I deeply craved. The foremost of those wrote me out of a clear sky and invited me to become his assistant. My works have all been published, and a foundation has been created to publish all that I may write in the future. The men with whom I have worked have been helpful and cooperative toward me, chiefly on account of my changed disposition. Formerly, they would not have endured me. As I look back over all these changes, it seems to me that in some blind way I stumbled on a path of life and set forces to working for me which before were against me." How an inventor used happy thoughts. Professor Elmer Gates of the Smithsonian Institution was one of the most successful inventors this country has ever known, and a recognized genius. He made a daily practice of calling up pleasant ideas and memories, and believed that this helped him in his work. "If a person wants to improve himself," he said, "let him summon those finer feelings of benevolence and usefulness which are called up only now and then. Let him make this a regular exercise, like swinging dumbbells. Let him gradually increase the time devoted to these psychical gymnastics, and at the end of a month, he will find the change in himself surprising. The alteration will be apparent in his actions and thoughts. Morally speaking, the man will be a great improvement of his former self. Matt Fury Commentary. Professor Elmer Gates's practice of calling up pleasant ideas and memories is one of the most important aspects of psychocybernetics. When we fail to recall our good moments, our best times, it's as if we've been disconnected from the source of all things good. But as soon as we remember and feel what it was like to be at our best, the switch is turned back on. We are reconnected, and we start experiencing bliss internally and externally. Our thoughts are not only positive, so are our feelings. And oddly enough, most of the circumstances we encounter that would have been negative in the past are now pleasant, harmonious, and vibrant. Back to Dr. Maltz. How to learn the happiness habit. Our self-image and our habits tend to go together. Change one and you will automatically change the other. The word habit originally meant a garment or clothing. We still speak of riding habits and habiliments. This gives us an insight into the true nature of habit. Our habits are literally garments worn by our personalities. They are not accidental or happenstance. We have them because they fit us. They are consistent with our self-image and our entire personality pattern. When we consciously and deliberately develop new and better habits, our self-image tends to outgrow the old habits and grow into the new pattern. I can see many patients cringe when I mention changing habitual action patterns or acting out new behavior patterns until they become automatic. They confuse habit with addiction. An addiction is something you feel compelled to, and which causes severe withdrawal symptoms. Treatment of addiction is beyond the scope of this audio program. Habits, on the other hand, are merely reactions and responses that we have learned to perform automatically without having to think or decide. They are performed by our creative mechanism. Fully 95% of our behavior, feeling, and response is habitual. The pianist does not decide which keys to strike. The dancer does not decide which foot to move where. The reaction is automatic and unthinking. In much the same way, our attitudes, emotions, and beliefs tend to become habitual. In the past, we learned that certain attitudes, ways of feeling and thinking, were appropriate to certain situations. Now we tend to think, feel, and act the same way whenever we encounter what we interpret as the same sort of situation. What we need to understand is that these habits, unlike addictions, can be modified, changed, or reversed simply by taking the trouble to make a conscious decision, and then by practicing or acting out the new response or behavior. The pianist can consciously decide to strike a different key, if he chooses. The dancer can consciously decide to learn a new step, and there is no agony about it. It does require constant watchfulness and practice until the new behavior pattern is thoroughly learned. Practice exercise. Habitually, you put on either your right shoe first or your left shoe. Habitually, you tie your shoes by either passing the right-hand lace around behind the left-hand lace, or vice versa. Tomorrow morning, determine which shoe you put on first and how you tie your shoes. Now consciously decide that for the next 21 days you are going to form a new habit by putting on the other shoe first and tying your laces in a different way. Each morning, as you decide to put on your shoes in a certain manner, let this simple act serve as a reminder to change other habitual ways of thinking, acting, and feeling throughout that one day. Say to yourself as you tie your shoes, "I am beginning the day in a new and better way." Then, consciously decide that throughout the day, 1. I will be as cheerful as possible. 2. I will try to feel and act a little more friendly toward other people. 3. I'm going to be a little less critical and a little more tolerant of other people, their faults, failings, and mistakes. I will place the best possible interpretation on their actions. 4. Insofar as possible, I'm going to act as if successes are inevitable, and I already am the sort of personality I want to be. I will practice acting like and feeling like this new personality. 5. I will not let my own opinion color facts in a pessimistic or negative way. 6. I will practice smiling at least 3 times during the day. 7. Regardless of what happens, I will react as calmly and as intelligently as possible. 8. I will ignore completely and close my mind to all those pessimistic and negative facts that I can do nothing to change. Simple? Yes. But each of these habitual ways of acting, feeling, thinking do have a beneficial and constructive influence on your self-image. Act them out for 21 days. Experience them and see if worry, guilt, hostility have not been diminished and if confidence has not been increased. At this point, you are welcome to pause the audio program and consider some of the key points that you've heard articulated in this chapter, as well as to consider some experiences you've had throughout your life that bring the concepts and principles to life for you. Chapter 8, Ingredients of the Success-Type Personality and How to Acquire Them. Just as a doctor learns to diagnose disease from certain symptoms, failure and success can also be diagnosed. The reason is that a man does not simply find success or come to failure. He carries their seeds around in his personality and character. I have found one of the most effective means of helping people achieve an adequate or successful personality is to first of all give them a graphic picture of what the successful personality looks like. Remember, the creative guidance mechanism within you is a goal-striving mechanism, and the first requisite for using it is to have a clear-cut goal or target to shoot for. A great many people want to improve themselves and long for a better personality, but have no clear-cut idea of the direction in which improvement lies or what constitutes a good personality. A good personality is one that enables you to deal effectively and appropriately with environment and reality and to gain satisfaction from reaching goals that are important to you. Time and again, I have seen confused and unhappy people straighten themselves out when they were given a goal to shoot for and a straight course to follow. There was the advertising man in his early 40s, for example, who felt strangely insecure and dissatisfied with himself just after receiving an important promotion. New roles require new self-images. "It doesn't make sense," said the ad man. "I've worked for this and dreamed about it. It's just what I've always wanted. I know I can do the work, and yet for some reason my self-confidence is shaken. I suddenly wake up, as if from a dream, and ask myself, what in the world is a small potato like me doing in a job like this? He had become super sensitive to his appearance and thought perhaps that his weak chin might be the cause of his discomfort. I don't look like a business executive, he said. He felt plastic surgery might be the answer to his problem. There was the stay-at-home mother whose children were running her crazy, and whose husband irritated her so much that she teed off on him at least once a week for no cause. What is the matter with me? She asked. My children are really nice kids I should be proud of. My husband is really a nice guy, and I'm always ashamed of myself afterwards. She felt that a facelift might give her more confidence and cause her family to appreciate her more. The trouble with these people, and many more like them, is not their physical appearance but their self-image. They find themselves in a new role and are not sure what kind of a person they are supposed to be in order to live up to that role. Or they have never developed a clear-cut self-image of themselves in any role. The picture of success. In this chapter, I'm going to give you the same prescription that I would give you should you come to my office. I have found that an easy-to-remember picture of the successful personality is contained in the letters of the word success itself. The success-type personality is composed of S, sense of direction, U, understanding, C, courage, C, compassion, E, esteem, S, self-confidence, S, self-acceptance. Sense of direction. The advertising executive straightened himself out and regained his confidence within a short time once he saw clearly that for several years he had been motivated by strong personal goals that he wanted to attain, including securing his present position. These goals, which were important to him, kept him on the track. However, once he got the promotion, he ceased to think in terms of what he wanted, but in terms of what others expected of him, or whether he was living up to other people's goals and standards. He was like the skipper of a ship who had relinquished his hold upon the wheel and hoped that he would drift in the right direction. He was like a mountain climber who, as long as he looked upward to the peak he wished to scale, felt and acted courageously and boldly. But when he got to the top, he felt there was nowhere else to go and began to look down and became afraid. He was now on the defensive, defending his present position, rather than acting like a goal striver and going on the offensive to attain his goal. He regained control when he set himself new goals and began to think in terms of, what do I want out of this job? What do I want to achieve? Where do I want to go? Functionally, a man is somewhat like a bicycle, I told him. A bicycle maintains its poise and equilibrium only so long as it is going forward towards something. You have a good bicycle. Your trouble is you are trying to maintain your balance sitting still, with no place to go. It's no wonder you feel shaky. We are engineered as goal-seeking mechanisms. We are built that way. When we have no personal goal that we are interested in and that means something to us, we are apt to go around in circles, feel lost, and find life itself aimless and purposeless. We are built to conquer environment, solve problems, achieve goals, and we find no real satisfaction or happiness in life without obstacles to conquer and goals to achieve. People who say that life is not worthwhile are really saying that they themselves have no personal goals that are worthwhile. Prescription. Get yourself a goal worth working for. Better still, get yourself a project. Decide what you want out of a situation. Always have something ahead of you to look forward to work for, and hope for. Look forward, not backward. Develop what one of the automobile manufacturers calls the forward look. Develop a nostalgia for the future instead of for the past. The forward look and a nostalgia for the future can keep you youthful. Even your body doesn't function well when you stop being a goal striver and have nothing to look forward to. This is the reason that very often when a man retires, he dies shortly thereafter. When you're not goal striving, not looking forward, you're not really living. In addition to your purely personal goals, have at least one impersonal goal or cause which you can identify yourself with. Get interested in some project to help your fellow man, not out of a sense of duty, but because you want to. Matt Fury commentary. Throughout his work, Dr. Maltz used two terms that some people find more beneficial than the word goal. The word goal causes a negative reaction or feeling of tension in some people. But if they use the word project or cause, they understand what they need to do. For example, Bob Bly, a successful writer and marketing master, insists he's never set a goal in his life, but he always has projects on his desk, always has something he's working on achieving. And in the same vein, when I asked my young daughter, Faith, what she wanted to accomplish, she replied, "I don't know." So I changed my question to, "What would you like to do?" She instantly began telling me what she wanted to get good at, not just do. If the word goal is not to your liking, use another word to help rather than hinder you on your journey. Now back to Dr. Maltz. Understanding. Understanding depends on good communication. Communication is vital to any guidance system or computer. You cannot react appropriately if the information you act on is faulty or misunderstood. Many doctors believe that confusion is the basic element in neurosis. To deal effectively with the problem, you must have some understanding of its true nature. Most of our failures in human relations are due to misunderstandings. We expect other people to react and respond and come to the same conclusions as we do from a given set of facts or circumstances. We should remember what we said in an earlier chapter. No one reacts to things as they are, but to his own mental images. Most of the time, the other person's reaction or position is not taken in order to make us suffer, nor to be hard-headed or malicious, but because he understands and interprets the situation differently from us. He is merely responding appropriately to what, to him, seems to be the truth about the situation. To give the other person credit for being sincere, if mistaken, rather than willful and malicious, can do much to smooth out human relations and bring about better understanding between people. Ask yourself, how does this appear to him? How does he interpret this situation? How does he feel about it? Try to understand why he might act the way he does. Fact versus opinion. Many times, we create confusion when we add our own opinion to facts and come up with the wrong conclusion. Fact: a husband cracks his knuckles. Opinion: the wife concludes, he does that because he thinks it will annoy me. Fact: the husband sucks his teeth after eating. Opinion: the wife concludes, if he had any regard for me, he would improve his manners. Fact: two friends are whispering when you walk up. Suddenly, they stop talking and look somewhat embarrassed. Opinion: you think they must have been gossiping about me. The wife mentioned earlier was able to understand that her husband's annoying mannerisms were not deliberate and willful acts on his part for the purpose of annoying her. When she stopped reacting just as if she had been personally insulted, she was able to pause, analyze the situation, and select an appropriate response. Be willing to see the truth. Oftentimes, we color incoming sensory data by our own fears, anxieties, or desires. But to deal effectively with environment, we must be willing to acknowledge the truth about it. Only when we understand what it is can we respond appropriately. We must be able to see the truth and to accept the truth, good or bad. Bertrand Russell said one reason Hitler lost World War II was that he did not fully understand the situation. Bearers of bad news were punished. Soon no one dared tell him the truth. Not knowing the truth, he could not act appropriately. Many of us are individually guilty of the same error. We do not like to admit to ourselves our errors, mistakes, shortcomings, or ever admit we have been in the wrong. We do not like to acknowledge that a situation is other than we would like it to be. So we kid ourselves. And because we will not see the truth, we cannot act appropriately. Someone has said that it is a good exercise to daily admit one painful fact about ourselves to ourselves. The success-type personality not only does not cheat and lie to other people, he learns to be honest with himself. What we call sincerity is itself based on self-understanding and self-honesty. For no man can be sincere who lies to himself by rationalizing or telling himself rational lies. Prescription: look for and seek out true information concerning yourself, your problems, other people, or the situation, whether it is good news or bad news. Adopt the motto, "It doesn't matter who's right, but what's right." An automatic guidance system corrects its course from negative feedback data. It acknowledges errors in order to correct them and stay on course. So must you. Admit your mistakes and errors, but don't cry over them. Correct them and go forward. In dealing with other people, try to see the situation from their point of view as well as your own. Courage. Having a goal and understanding the situation are not enough. You must have the courage to act. For only by actions can goals, desires, and beliefs be translated into realities. Admiral William F. Halsey's personal motto was a quotation from Nelson: "No captain can do very wrong if he places his ship alongside that of an enemy." "The best defense is a strong offense," is a military principle, said Halsey, "but its application is wider than war. All problems, personal, national, or combat, become smaller if you don't dodge them, but confront them. Touch a thistle timidly, and it pricks you. Grasp it boldly, and its spines crumble." Someone has said that faith is not believing something in spite of the evidence. It is the courage to do something regardless of the consequences. Why not bet on yourself? Nothing in this world is ever absolutely certain or guaranteed. Often, the difference between a successful man and a failure is not one's better abilities or ideas, but the courage that one has to bet on his ideas, to take a calculated risk, and to act. We often think of courage in terms of heroic deeds on the battlefield, in a shipwreck or similar crisis. But everyday living requires courage too, if it is to be effective. Standing still, failure to act, causes people who are faced with a problem to become nervous, feel stymied, trapped, and can bring on a host of physical symptoms. I tell such people, study the situation thoroughly. Go over in your imagination the various courses of action possible to you and the consequences which can and may follow from each course. Pick out the course which gives the most promise and go ahead. If we wait until we are absolutely certain and sure before we act, we will never do anything. Anytime you act, you can be wrong. Any decision you make can turn out to be the wrong one. But we must not let this deter us from going after the goal we want. You must daily have the courage to risk making mistakes, risk failure, risk being humiliated. A step in the wrong direction is better than staying on the spot all your life. Once you're moving forward, you can correct your course as you go. Your automatic guidance system cannot guide you when you're stalled, standing still. Faith and courage are natural instincts. Have you ever wondered why the urge or desire to gamble seems to be instinctive in human nature? My own theory is that this universal urge is an instinct, which, when used correctly, urges us to bet on ourselves, to take a chance on our own creative potentialities. When we have faith and act with courage, that is exactly what we're doing, gambling on and taking a chance on our own creative God-given talents. It is also my theory that people who frustrate this natural instinct by refusing to live creatively and act with courage are the people who develop gambling fever and become addicts of gambling tables. A man who will not take a chance on himself must bet on something. And the man who will not act with courage sometimes seeks the feeling of courage from a bottle. Faith and courage are natural human instincts, and we feel a need to express them in one way or another. Prescription. Be willing to make a few mistakes, to suffer a little pain to get what you want. Don't sell yourself short. Most people, said General R.E. Chambers, chief of the Army's Psychiatry and Neurology Consultant Division, don't know how brave they really are. In fact, many potential heroes, both men and women, live out their lives in self-doubt. If they only knew they had these deep resources, it would help give them the self-reliance to meet most problems, even a big crisis. You've got the resources, but you never know you've got them until you act and give them a chance to work for you. Another helpful suggestion is to practice acting boldly and with courage in regard to little things. Do not wait until you can be a big hero in some dire crisis. Daily living also requires courage, and by practicing courage in little things, we develop the power and talent to act courageously in more important matters. Compassion. Successful personalities have some interest in and regard for other people. They have a respect for others' problems and needs. They respect the dignity of human personality and deal with other people as if they were human beings, rather than as pawns in their own game. They recognize that every person is a child of God and is a unique individual who deserves some dignity and respect. It is a psychological fact